And good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to The Higher Dimension on BBS Radio. I'm Phyllis Pricer, your hostess, and today we have, again, a guest we had a few weeks ago, Steve Riles, who is the author of a book called Drunk with Wonder, a book that I really love. It's Awakening to the God Within. It's written as a dialogue format, if you listened before. And in it, he addresses a lot of information that looks channeled, and I believe it is channeled through spirit and through inspiration. And welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you so much, Phyllis. It's great to be back.
I am so glad to have you. We were talking just a few moments ago how wonderful the day is where I am, and he says it's wonderful where he is. So hopefully we've got most of the nation between us that we can say it's just wonderful.
I love spring.
Well, me too. I am now looking with longing eyes at doing a garden. I put everything, since I live in the city, in pots, basically, and it keeps it a lot safer from postmen walking across the lawn, you know, people who ride up, all sorts of stuff. But it also cuts down on the cats and the doggies getting in it and doing their little thing in the flowers, which annoys me no end. If I plant it, I don't want it pooped or peed in.
Yeah. Up our way, it's more like, a six-foot fence to keep the deer out.
Oh, that too. Although if you have a couple dogs in your yard, that usually discourages them from coming too close.
True.
That's what I found when I lived in the Flint Hill, which is the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains down in Virginia.
Uh-huh.
So at any rate, I am so delighted to have you back on. We had a lovely chat last time, and the hour just whiled itself away, and I was so surprised to find out how far it went without really realizing that we hadn't been able to discuss a lot of what's in your book. But I'd like to get more into it again, and some of it. Did you have anything? Were you inspired to bring up anything today?
I tell you what, Phyllis, I am so inspired to trust spirit. And trust the moment. That's kind of been my spiritual practice lately.
Yes.
If I could winnow it down to one word, it would be trust.
Yes,
so,
and that's a hard one, isn't it?
It has been challenging in my life.
That's one of my challenges, is trusting, too. And I have been learning to do that, and things seem to be coming together through trust. But I'll tell you something, it's been a long, hard haul. And trust is something I think you lose a lot of when you're a little child, and getting it back to where you were childlike is hard.
It can be very challenging.
Yes.
When I talk about being drunk with wonder, when I allude to small children who are fully engaged in the world and fully expressed in that sense of wonder, they haven't had that choked off yet. They haven't had the been told to sit down in rows and shut up and don't move and don't express your body
and don't think.
Certainly don't express your feelings.
Yeah. Don't think. I love that one. Just do what I tell you.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things, you want to just grow by and slap somebody at that point. Unfortunately, they take it amiss when you do.
mm-hmm.
Not that I've tried it often, mind you. Anyway, I was looking at something that I just sort of thumbed through your book today. Two things caught my mind. Emotional icebergs and our personal Titanic. And then what followed that was escaping from the pit of despair. Now, I think that can address today's worries for many, many people. The economic situation, personal situations. There is so much fear right now. There are people shooting people, not that you follow, I think it's from despair, parents killing themselves and their children, people doing things that are just totally crazy, and I think from despair, and I think because they had their own personal Titanics, and I also think they didn't accept personal responsibility for where they were, blaming it on them, on other people and circumstances, rather than saying, I can change this. They use, which is another title to one of your chapters, victimization.
Right.
As a reason for not standing up and being a co-creator in their own lives. Do you think we could go through some of that?
Oh, you bet. Where would you like to start?
where would you want us to begin? Because I guess, in a sense, how about personal responsibility? How about
this is it's an extra great time to practice trust in the world, to practice knowing that God is all there is, and that at a very profound level, it's all in divine order. And when we're raised on fear and lack, and a lack of self-worth, a lack of sense of the innate divinity that really beats all of our hearts, then it's relatively easy to look around and play the blame game, do the victim game, you know, whether it's being made fun of by bullies or other people, or feeling as though, quote, the system, unquote, is out to get me, or it doesn't care, or I don't see any way out of this situation. Mm-hmm. Whether the situation is I've been laid off for 6 months, or I bought way more house than I could afford at a, you know, and signed on for a terrible deal that, has blown up in my face. It's their fault. Again, there's no personal responsibility. And it can be one of the most challenging processes or parts of waking up, awakening, is to take on the responsibility, take on the ownership of all of our life experience. And then, on top of that, to not sit in blame. Make wrong. We're all experts on making ourselves and other people wrong for the situation. And it's just that in the blink of an eye, we can turn from blame to responsibility. We can take any situation and we can turn it into gold. We truly can. It's all about the choices we make in the moment.
And how we perceive things. That's another way. I have faced some very serious issues in my life, some very serious times where I had everything that I had wanted and a great income and my family. And in just a short period of time, I lost a great deal in 1 month. And, you know, I didn't blame others. I just went into what I call hibernation. Some might call it clinical depression, okay? And I just wanted to hide from the world. I just didn't want to be alive any longer or stay. But in that darkness, as I call going to the gates of hell and back, I found that there was more to me, and that I could trust myself, and that I was much more talented and capable and competent than I ever thought. But it took me to lose almost everything, okay, and to hover on the brink of total financial disaster. I came like 90% close. But in doing so, I found that I had qualities that were within me that would not have come out had I not lost what I did. I would have been content to stay in a place, and I think God has found something else, or he gave me an idea that was more for me to do. I had inspiration, but I couldn't see myself doing it. And even so, even when I lost everything, I said, well, now how do you expect me to do it? I couldn't do it before. Now what? Was I crazy? Did I get a lie? Did I have a brainstorm or a brain fart, whatever you want to call it? You know, did I have a sort of a fever and dementia that I couldn't, that I think I believed something was supposed to do, happen, that I was supposed to do good? And yet, now I find it's coming about because I realized that there was a weakness in me that needed to be addressed and strengthened. And that weakness was, what, lack of trust. Lack of trusting the universe. Lack of believing in myself. Lack of believing that there was more for me to do than just exist in this world. There was a whole lot that went with it, and I had to learn to, what, trust in myself and my skills and capabilities, which was really hard to do.
Why did you find that so hard to do? What do you think was so hard about that?
Well, I think part of it was some experiences I had when I was younger, and also, I know this sounds like the old party line, but my mother truly believed and drummed in my head that you need a man in your life for a girl. This is. In order to do things. And you needed to get married to have somebody to support you. And you couldn't do it by yourself. You needed a man, no matter what. And, you know, and without a man, you were lost and you couldn't do it and you wouldn't be able to survive and handle things on your own. That was the security you needed. And that was the mistake, because I fed into it or bought into it, shall we say. And even though I was on the surface very independent, there was still that doubt inside of me that I could do what I wanted to do and do it on my own without being helped and handed things and without having somebody hold my hand and walk me through it. I lacked my own confidence. And that's what I needed to grow through, that I didn't need a helping hand that way.
Yeah, that's a deep neuronal pathway to overcome, to move past. And congratulations on your success with that. It's, you know, and I know it's all story at some level, Phyllis.
Yes.
And I think the trick is to learn that and then to choose stories that work for us better. But one of the stories that works for me when hearing stories like your own story is that, let's see, how do I put this, is that I think that we come through, when I say come through, come into an incarnation, come into a life by choice.
Right.
I don't think we're ever made to or forced to in any way. And that we volunteer to take on particular, let's call them challenges, specifically so that if we can heal out of those challenges, that we can move beyond them, then we can spend the rest of our lives as a beacon, vibrating in a frequency that many others will be able to resonate with in a very congruent, authentic way. Because when we're broken in a way by life's experiences, our hearts break open, and we are able to stitch them back together, larger than the way they were before, then our very vibrational frequency allows other people to see that even though they are broken in similar ways or feel broken in similar ways, they too can heal. And I think on an energetic level, even before any words are spoken, that has a tremendous positive benefit to the world.
Well, I agree with you absolutely. That's what we call leadership. That's what we call, because I don't think you can be a good leader. But the thing that I learned most was, no one can be a good king or queen or a good leader until they know how to be a good subject or a good follower.
You know? And I think there's a form of leadership called exemplary leadership.
Yes.
And that's basically leading by example.
Example. Yes.
And that's the only kind of leadership that I really pay much attention to myself, is the people who are walking their talk.
Exactly. And you know, you can't fool them, especially the younger they are, the less likely you are to fool them, because they still have enough touch.
I was at a youth conference about 3 weeks ago, and we did a breakout session, and there was, there's a lot of concern in our rural community about drug abuse and these meth labs and this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yes.
You know, there's a couple of people from the sheriff's department who are there yakking at the kids from this kind of a academic, you know, ivory tower position, where the kids were just not relating to that at all. And I kind of raised my hand and said, yeah, well, I was actually on the street addicted to meth for a year, 40 years ago. So would you like to hear about how it really is? And then the kids were just glued, you know, because there's somebody who's actually been there and has healed out of it and can see the allure and see the trap and talk about all of that. And, you know, there just isn't any substitute for someone who's been willing to walk through that fire and come out the other side and then share their experience.
Well, I have to agree with you. The nuns taught me when I was privileged in being sent to a private boarding school, and I was raised Catholic, so I had a wonderful education. I had older parents, so I was an only child, basically. Even though I had a stepbrother and stepsister, they were often married by the time my stepfather and mother married. But the thing is, I was given a wonderful education, and the nuns taught us how to clean our rooms. And the theory was that even if you grow up to become wealthy and you have people to clean your house, how will you know how to do it or if they're doing their job right or how can you help them if you don't know what they're doing? Hmm. So we were taught to do the work ourselves and to do it right so that we could, in essence, say, look, I know what it takes to clean. I know what it takes to do this, that, or the other thing. And, you know, it worked for us.
I didn't like it, but that's beside the point.
But I ended up cleaning house because I sure didn't end up having servants for many a year. Trust me on that one.
Yeah.
And I knew how to clean a house, and I knew how to do it right. And so I, when I, you know, put the energy in, but it takes a long while sometimes to overcome what we go through. And I think it also takes us to come to a point where we can't go any lower, where we hit the bottom, where we bottomed out. And for each person, I think the bottom is at whatever level it is. For you, it was in one area. For me, it was another. And for each individual, their bottom comes at a level where their soul says they can't get any lower. And you have to go back up. You don't have a choice.
Yeah, it can be absolutely be as stark as choosing life or death.
Right, exactly.
Which is certainly an experience that I've had.
Well, yeah, I've been there too. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I've so wished that it didn't have to be that way. I mean, I don't actually know for a fact that it has to be that way.
I don't.
And when I speak of that way, I mean, you know, hitting bottom.
Yes.
But I know it's relatively common that if a person feels content or happy or things are going fine, then there is much less of a push to look at things differently or to try doing life differently. It's much more rare, it seems to me, or at least in my experience, that I have met people who have had things going for them and then chosen to do it different. I mean, I don't know of a greater teacher than Buddha, who
exactly.
was raised as a wealthy prince and was, you know, walked away from stepping into being king and so on, and very consciously took on a different life. But a lot of people raised in similar situations don't take on a different life.
I understand that, but Gandhi was another one who did have some of a privilege, maybe not as much as Buddha, but I think most great leaders do come from a background where they choose. And I think it's in part for what you say is true in that they can share. They can become someone whom they can say, I walked this line. I know what you're talking about. I've been where you are. So I can say with confidence, this is how it is for me. And I think each person, I know with my children, I would try and teach them and tell them what happened to me, et cetera. But, you know, sometimes people have to experience it for themselves. That's the only way that they can learn, through experiential means.
Yeah.
And I agree, you don't have to do that. But when we get really complacent, we get kind of lazy. And we all are just human beings, and it's so much more easier for somebody to plump, you know, peel grapes in our mouths and pop little bonbons in and make life smooth and easy so we don't have to step in any of the mud. We don't have to sweat unless we're at the gym. You know, and it's just because we become so involved in ourselves, we are no longer aware of those around us. And I think that's where the issue is. We need to become aware of those around us.
Yes, broaden our perspective.
Yes.
And we can only do that, it seems to me, I'm only successful, I'll just talk about me, when being more aware of people around me, when I'm willing to drop my stories and my and being completely taken in by my thoughts and sit in a more serene place of being present in the moment and be available for people. However they show up, and be willing to be a loving, you know, be filled with loving kindness, and compassion and forgiveness and mercy and hang out. And it's an amazing place to be willing to hang out. I'm convinced that every one of us comes through. We volunteer. We say, I'm going to go for this one this time, and see if I can't heal out of this wound, and then. Show up for other people in the world.
Right.
I, you know, and then there are examples out there who are so stunning so huge in terms of what they're willing, how they're willing to show up in the world,
right,
and what they're willing to go through in order to be able to show up that way. I think of Viktor Frankl. I imagine you know who that is.
Yes.
He was a prisoner in World War II in the Nazi concentration camp, and he survived. And he not only survived, but he managed to survive with a level of compassion even for his guards.
I remember that.
It's just an one of the most astonishing stories I've ever read in my life.
Yes,
and
I have heard of him,
Yeah, he's a... I talk about him for anybody who has the book or wants to get it. The chapter titled The Miracle of Choice, I talk about him. And that amazing place that even when it seems the darkest and the most scary, their choice is still possible.
Yes.
And we can choose to stand in the fire of our fear and choose love, even in that moment. It's possible. Not that it's, quote, easy, unquote.
Oh, no.
Not that
it's,
you know, not that we have a lot of models for that activity around us, but it is possible. And most of us, fortunately, don't have to go through being in a concentration camp or being shot at or feeling that our day-to-day lives, that there's something to really be seriously afraid of. So most of us have an opportunity to spend time meditating if we choose and beginning to sort out who we really are from all of these stories of fear and lack that we were raised with.
And the fear and lack continues on when you read something in the paper, which mostly is fear and lack. And I think that's a part of the issue that people have, is so much now is written that, you know, it's hard to find out. They turn from one thing to another, so you're almost writhing in pain when you turn onto TV or you turn on the show to hear how much people are being hurt. And the thing is, if we would each of us turn our minds to not being hurt, to being creators, we would not have this. But again, it's a choice that we make. And each of us, I think, because of who we are, because we are co-creators, we have to come to that conscious decision ourselves. We can't do it by letting other people do it for us. We can't walk the walk in somebody else's shoes. We have to walk it in our own shoes.
That's true.
And that's something that's very, very difficult, I think, because people are always looking for the shortcut or the easy way to do something.
Well, that's the way that's the way this culture, you know, has been raised, in a sense that, you know, what's the fastest pill? You know,
exactly.
I don't want to have to actually exercise, or I just want to take a...
Now you're heading too close to home.
Well, I exercise, and I struggle with my weight all my life. So, you know, but it's you know, do I exercise, or do I take a statin? Do I?
Yes,
you know,
I hear what you
do say. You know what? Do I just sit around and pretend I don't have a body, or do I get out there and chop my firewood and, you know, run my chainsaw and my weed eater? And we have 40 acres here in the mountains of Northern California, and so it's a, you know, it's a massive amount of land to try to even keep track of just a few acres right around the house and so on. And of course we live in very, very dangerous fire country, and here we go again. You know, last year we had several fires in the immediate area, and we were on extreme high alert, mandatory evacuation kind of high alert for a couple of weeks. And I you know, now I have some profoundly greater sense than I had of what it's like to be in a war, you know, what it's like to be in battle with that level of profound adrenaline running all day, every day, day after day after day after day. You know, most of us only experience that if we haven't been soldiers ourselves or aren't in the, you know, aren't a fireman or a policeman or, you know,
or facing some sort of danger,
some kind of imminent danger, you know, imminent physical threat on a regular basis. It's just overwhelming to experience that kind of adrenaline and that kind of intensity.
And not only that, it takes down your body too. It stresses the body phenomenally.
I mean, the only thing that made any sense for me during that time was just to be outside working. And,
well,
and running, you know, working the adrenaline. It's amazing how much we had volunteers, we had friends come up, we had you know, the standing joke was we got 10 years worth of yard work done in a week.
This is a good thing. See, benefits come.
See, there are gifts everywhere. There are gifts everywhere. And you know what's funny? We can look out our, we have this tremendous view out the front. And when I say tremendous view, I mean 20 miles from us is the ocean. And we can see a strip of it.
And
forest-covered hills. And there's a hill right out in front here, less than a mile away, that burned. And then there's a hill to the north of that that didn't burn. And you can see a profound difference in the kind of fluorescent green of the grass, because the area that burned is this deeper, more luscious, lustrous green. And you think, okay, gift of fire ecology is that when, you know, when we don't get in the way of nature, nature knows how to take care of herself.
And then regroup.
And then what we think of as this catastrophic fire, we have a just, what is it, about 5 miles from us, we have a redwood grove preserve called Montgomery Woods. And the fire ripped through a whole bunch of that area. But it, you know, you go back a few months later and the ferns have grown back so densely on the forest floor that there are whole areas you walk through and you go, this didn't burn. And then you look more closely and go, God, it did burn. Amazing, you know. And, of course, the mighty redwoods were completely unfazed. Even if the fire burned 50 feet up the bark on the outside of the trees are still thriving. And it's just a different perspective, you know, when you let go of so quickly saying good and bad, fire bad, you know, and just go, this is part of the natural cycle, and then watch it through the course of a year, it's astonishing where you see gift after gift and wildflowers that haven't bloomed in years. And, you know, when you're in the way personally, your place gets burned down, that will change your life. I was in an apartment fire in Oakland 35 years ago, and that changed my life. That's all I can say. It was very intense, and I really know what that's like to wind up sleeping, you know, in a friend's furnace room because you don't have any place to go, and you watch your things being shoveled out into the sidewalk and so on. It's a very different experience to have those kinds of things happen to you. So
exactly.
I think sometimes we take on these lessons, these life lessons, and then if we choose to learn from them, we can become available as mentors or teachers or coaches for people who are struggling through their own versions of some of these stories. I'm sure you've seen that in your work.
Oh, yes, yes. I've seen it, and I was blessed in some ways. There's been, and I'm just, as you were talking, I don't know why this came to mind. I brought back to mind aftermath of World War II when I was a young child in grade school. And we had some people who were kept, and I've met a few over the years, very few, who were in concentration camps. And I met children who were, and saw the ravages of their children who've been born in a concentration camp, whose mother's been pregnant when they were put in there. Some of them, they weren't Jews, they were Hungarians, or they were Polish, or what have you, okay? And they were brought over here, immigrant status, to help them through the churches and some charitable organizations. And I remember having them live, one girl in my school, and then some living next door, and then meeting some in business later on. And when people tried to, and I listened to their stories and what it was like, and my heart just ached. And yet, sometime now, I hear people say, oh, it never happened. It was exaggerated. Not that many people were killed, so forth and so on. And I just turn around and look, well, I met them personally. I saw what the response was. I saw what these children suffered by way of ill health and poor care on the part of their mothers because they got no natal care and their mothers were starved. I saw, you know, children with rotted stumps of teeth because they had no calcium for the mothers to drink, all sorts of things. And I saw the tattoos on the children's arms, you know, that were put there when they were babies.
Mm-hmm.
And when somebody says, well, it didn't exist, and I look at them, no, no, it did. I met these people. You try to convince me that something doesn't exist because I've seen it. I have experienced what those people went through because through their own words. You know, that now, then people will be quiet and listen and say, well, I didn't realize it. And the thing is, we each of us have a hard time, each generation has a hard time learning from the prior generation. I think that's what puzzles me a lot, is there is a desire not to learn through the experience unless you have to go through it. That's so sad.
Yeah, there's a sense of willful, willful denial when people start talking like that. It's it really truly amazes me. Right now, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how the Depression wasn't as bad as it was, and that it was, and you know, and that Hoover was doing fine, and that it was FDR caused the Depression, and I mean, just utter absurd revision of clear historical fact.
Right.
It fascinates me that people are so threatened by the truth that they will manufacture, you know, really amazing stories. And I think that a lot of the people who are Holocaust deniers really don't have any way to be with the truth. You know, they're just, their hearts aren't big enough, haven't gotten an opportunity to grow their hearts to a place where they can encompass that level of tragedy.
I think some people want to say that it couldn't possibly have been that way. Nobody could have been that cruel uncaring. Okay?
Yeah. And yet we see pieces of it over and over again, whether it's Rwanda or Kosovo.
Exactly.
Or Ethiopia, Eritrea, Darfur, Cambodia, just all in our lifetimes.
Yeah.
Many, many more millions of people have been slaughtered in various genocidal activities.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm reminded of Debbie Ford's work. Are you familiar with her? She's a great writer and teacher. She does one of the great books, The Secret of the Shadow, Owning Your Whole Story.
Okay.
And that, you know, she asked questions like, would you rather be good or would you rather be whole?
Mm-hmm.
And she talks a lot. I just very deeply resonated with this work about 10 years ago, with the idea that what we most don't want to own,
mm-hmm.
and I'll repeat that, what we most don't want to own, we project onto other people.
That's it. That's
and
it.
You probably are very aware of that. And so I see this on a mass basis, very, very continuously operating, where people wind up blaming other people or institutions for for the wrongs of the world or what's happened to them.
Yeah.
And again, it's an opportunity to play the victim. And when we play the victim, the gift, you know, or the there's always some kind of payoff for what we
right.
do. And the payoff for being a victim is that we don't have to take responsibility. Because when we take responsibility, the buck stops here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all of a sudden, it's not about what other people are doing or not doing. I mean, the truth is that because my wife and I live in a way rather fiscally conservatively,
right.
even though this is a challenging time financially, we're doing fine. Our car's paid
right.
off. This 40 acres in the home is paid off. So their interest rate is irrelevant, and people defaulting, you know, it's horrifying and very sad when we see other people who are going through such enormous suffering. And yet, as you pointed out earlier in this broadcast, Phyllis, for some reason, many people seem to need some kind of profound cathartic shock in order to move out of their conditioned stories and take on a larger role in life. And I guess we could say one of the gifts of this whole tsunami of financial craziness is that a whole lot of people are having an opportunity to change their stories and to grow out of who they thought they were. And you could ultimately see that as a gift. And, you know, we keep talking about creating a new world, right? We have this vast dream of creating a new world. Well, you know, we need building blocks for that new world, and so there's a way in which we need to dismantle a lot of this world in order to get those building blocks to build the new one.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And we are definitely doing some demolition.
A demolition derby comes to mind. Yes, sir. Indeed.
Oh, my gosh.
I've never been fond of demolition derbies, but then again. My feeling is also that a lot of people have put themselves unconsciously into a situation where they will be forced to learn. And that is, again, something that we have agreed to before we even came here, is that we all are participating in our own graceful dance of life itself. And for me, that is one of the greatest gifts that we have. The despair that we feel is, how would you suggest that some people pull out of it? Because you have escaping from that pit of despair and reinforcing what it has, but changing. Changing is you have the ability to change yourself. All you have to say is, I want to change. I don't want to continue down this path. You have that ability, and immediately things begin to change in your life. It's your choice to shift it.
Yes, it is, and of course, until you know you have a choice, it might be not very meaningful to say that to somebody if they've never personally experienced it. And in Drunk with Wonder, I talk quite a bit about this idea of escaping from the pit of despair, and I preface that explanation with this whole story about the triune brain, and this whole notion that there are neuronal pathways, or think of them as circuits, circuits that are wired into us from birth, others that we acquire as we grow up from the experiences we have. But one of the deepest neuronal pathways actually extends from our eyes and our ears to our the reptilian part of our brain, and it's run through the amygdala, and these are, we think of the startle reflex, we think of the fight or flight response.
Right.
This is a very different than chronic anxiety or chronic fear or what have you. This causes the body to very quickly move into a very highly aware, acutely able to engage in strenuous physical activity immediately, so that if the big cat is coughing behind you in the forest, you're up the tree, you're not thinking, am I in danger here, maybe I should I run, because
you can't analyze it, is what you're saying. No,
exactly, and to understand the circuitry of the brain, I think some people find this very useful, I know I did, that you realize that these deep circuits for fight or flight, they don't go through the cerebral cortex. They're not hooked through the cerebral cortex. They go directly from the eyes and the ears, directly down to the reptilian part of the brain that sits on top of the brain stem, which has to do with our autonomic nervous system and our reflexes and our instincts.
Right.
And so when we get into this kind of pit of despair, this emotional, life is really, I don't see how I can get out of this. I know I call these episodes getting triggered.
Okay.
And I would love to say that I never get triggered anymore, but it does happen from time to time. And what I've learned is that because I understand the physiology now, I understand that there are these big, it's like super highways of neuronal pathways that will trigger us into this kind of fear or depressed place. But there aren't any super highways out of there. It's
really?
Sort of like you get up the tree, and then you just let over time, the neuronal pathways calm down, and the chemicals calm down, and the adrenaline calms down, and you're able to resume your activities. In our case, we often feel like we've gotten stuck.
Right.
And when we feel like we're stuck, to be able to escape from the pit of despair, the first step is to own that we feel stuck, that we feel trapped. The very act of kind of turning around, you can imagine this metaphorically, of turning around and looking at ourselves and going, oh, man, boy, I got myself stuck this time. And then doing something really visceral, like, you know, maybe get out of your chair, get up off the bed, and pretend like you're trapped in a carpet. And then, oh, move that foot! Get that out of that quicksand! Ah, there, I got one. And then you get the other one out, and you're moving really slow, and you get that one out. And those kinds of activities where you use your body can be enormously helpful because it's really a body thing. You know, trauma gets locked into cellular memory with adrenaline.
Because it sends the chemical through your body, and your body is now just in a reactive mode.
Right.
Rather than a proactive.
So when you're able to start playing with it, as soon as you begin to reengage your cerebral cortex and your thinking, then you can start, like, playing with it. So if you feel really, really stuck, feel really, really depressed, what is depressed when a person is depressed is their feelings.
Right.
It's their emotions. That's what's depressed.
Yeah.
And when we sit on all of these emotions and they become toxic,
right,
that's when people will commit suicide, is because it seems so toxic and so yucky that they can't see any way out.
And they can't move.
And the way out is to begin moving. The way out is you know, if you're in a safe place, where you're not going to scare anybody, scream for a while, cry, yell. I go out and chop some wood, or take a big stick and bang on a trunk, or if you're in the city, get a wiffle bat and beat the crap out of your bedspread. There are ways to move. There are ways to move the energy, is what I'm trying to say.
I remember what I used to do, and that would be I used to go out and what I call beat the earth. I'd go out and take a hoe and start going after weeds.
There you go. And the trick here is to do it with enough consciousness that you're aware that you're moving energy.
Exactly.
That when we get stuck, when we get trapped, when we feel trapped in the pit of despair, when we're depressed, what's going on physiologically is that energy isn't moving in our bodies.
Uh-huh.
And the secret is to start moving energy.
No matter what.
Clear research that shows that a person feeling depressed, if they get up and go walk for a half hour, an hour, and they come back, when they clinically evaluate the person again, the depression has lifted amazingly.
Yes, and they pop pills.
Exactly. It's so much. So when we learn about this by reading Drunk with Wonder or other books that talk about this, when we learn about it and begin to understand it and begin to apply our understanding, then we can begin to, at the very least, shorten the episodes where we're feeling stuck.
Right.
And we begin to feel as though, you know, I've got some control around this. I tell you, when, oh, golly, 35 years ago in my 20s, I found myself, after I graduated from Berkeley, within a couple of years, I was with a woman that I love very much, and she had two children. So here I was working full-time as a salesman, coat and tie, company car, helping raise this family, and there was a part of me that just got, this isn't what I was going to do, you know. I was going to go out and write the great poems and the great novel and change the world, and, you know, and there are times when I get so depressed, I just lie down on my bed on Friday afternoon, and I would not get up till Monday morning. I just didn't watch TV or listen to music or talk to anybody or eat. I just was deeply depressed.
Yeah, a pity party.
Yeah, exactly, a pity party.
Wow.
But I want to give people even more of a sense. You know, we talk about a pity party. That, ouch. You know, it's, I want to bring in Kuan Yin and compassion and mercy and forgiveness, and have us be gentle with ourselves, because I think sometimes when we get into this pit of despair, part of what's going on is we're going, oh, look, see, you did it again, you loser. You can't even stay out of this. You know, what's wrong with you? You know, that inner judge, just yanny, yanny, yanny. And that will drive us deeper into the pit.
Yes.
So I want to really recommend that people breathe. I always recommend that people breathe and notice what's going on and deliberately choose to do something with your body to start moving energy. And I guarantee, I absolutely guarantee that if you're willing to follow these steps, you will notice a shift.
Well, it has to, because you have, by your very physical action, you've implemented a course of action, which is change.
Right.
You've given yourself permission to move.
Absolutely.
And that makes good conscious sense. Oh, well, this is really fabulous. We're working on it. I'm hoping that people are listening to this. It's very quiet, suspiciously quiet. Nobody's calling in. You know you can call in, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a comment or if you're enjoying this. I'm so glad. Just let us know afterwards that you've enjoyed it. But I am talking with Steve, and his book is Drunk with Wonder, Awakening to God Within. And it's a very good book. Tell them where you can get it, please.
Okay, well, my book's available online on my website, which is Drunk with Wonder, all one word, drunkwithwonder.com. If people want to order it by phone, I've got a 24/7 800 number, which is 247-6553. That's 800-247-6553, and you can order it with your credit card. You can also go to my website and order it. It's on Amazon.com. I also have a free monthly newsletter. I love new subscribers. You can sign up for that online on my homepage. And I also have an audio version of the book that I'm really, really pleased with that is available on iTunes or Audible.com.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Things are just seeming to be moving forward for you.
Yes, they are. I feel very blessed.
Oh, wonderful. At any rate, we want to go now towards near the end, since we're coming down to the tail end of our show. What are some of the things that you feel that you haven't yet addressed that it's important for you to share with our listeners and with just people in general? Because we have a lot that's happening right now out there, and I know you're very upbeat, and I feel upbeat, too. I feel there's a change coming in consciousness, and I feel that many people are participating in this change. Do you agree?
I do agree. One of the things that I've been very fascinated to notice is that in many cases, people who have been laid off have decided to go out into the community and begin volunteering. So even though donations, financial donations to many charities have dropped off as people have lost their jobs, the number of people showing up to help, physically help, has jumped dramatically.
And
that's another point I want to make about if someone's been laid off, if someone's struggling financially.
Yes.
I mean, there's only so many hours in the day that you can really put into looking for a job. And one of the most important things you can do, both for yourself and your community, is to get out there and find a cause that you can support, even if it's only for an hour a day, a couple of days a week, or showing up on a Saturday morning to help paint a Habitat for Humanity house.
Right.
Whatever it might be, you're putting energy back into your community, and it's going to pay off. And you're also going to feel more useful and like you're part of something bigger than yourself. And that's one of the keys. People who are depressed inevitably feel alone, isolated, separated, and just going out into the community and making a difference, whether it's helping in a food bank, they're always looking. There's so many places that are always looking for help. I recommend so highly that you get engaged. It's another thing you can do with your body, and when you can see that something you're doing is making a difference, you get kind of instant gratification.
Yes.
And it's another way of completing the circuit. Because, you know, this sacred circuit, the sacred hoop, the sacred wheel is as I see it, is where, you know, God as us, God as all, God, Goddess as all, is one. The one gift of that unconditional love is the gift of life itself.
Mm-hmm.
And we're, you know, we're God in form. We're the expressed form of that unconditional love. And whenever we then take that love that comes pouring out of our hearts, mm-hmm. and give it back into the universe, we're completing the circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And when we are living from that place where we are a living part of the sacred hoop, magic happens. Miracles happen.
Yes.
And I know you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do. I've been working with the little children in a local facility, a medical facility, with children who are born very often premature and born with some severe, some not so severe physical and, I guess, mental challenges too, but certainly physical from the get-go. And to me, they are the most precious gift. And I look at them and I see that I am blessed to be able to work with them and to hold them in my arms and to just love them. And it's part of what's allowed me to open my heart again fully to share in the joy of giving unconditionally to little beings. And when I see them, I see God in human form.
Absolutely.
And I am so privileged to be able to work with them and to enjoy them. And they enjoy me. I don't know who gets more benefit out of it, them or me. It's a foot race in that one.
Isn't that a funny thing? Yeah, I work. I'm really drawn to working with teens, and
mm-hmm.
and so I have been doing that for 14 years. And I was at an all-day event a few weeks ago for teen leadership in our county,
right.
And I'm just astonished. People say, "How can you be so positive and optimistic?" I have a spiritual practice and a spiritual community, but, you know, one of the big secrets is that I go hang out with teenagers who are committed to changing the world. And they have so much energy and passion and drive. They are so articulate. They are so intelligent that I think, oh, really, we're in good hands in so many ways.
Yes.
And that's a tremendously positive development, I think.
Oh, and it is. And they're smarter than the average bear. I remember I have children that they're like 17 years apart, and raising the last one was so much different than raising the first two who were close together. And I thought maybe, but it was just the kids. And somebody said TV. I said, no, we had TV with the first two. But it wasn't that. It's just that the one that was born last seems a lot more intelligent, a lot more savvy. I had to learn to reach and stretch more than I did with the first two. There seemed to be an understanding and a knowledge about her that was spiritual in basis that was not the same as with the two older. Not that the two older aren't wonderful human beings in their own right. They are.
Sure, sure.
But it's just that there was a difference. It's like the children are smarter now. They know more. They have more knowledge and wisdom and understanding. And you really can't sit on your buns and, you know, play your violin. You got to get up there and learn and reach so you can be smarter than they are, so you can help them grow. It's forcing yourself to grow, to keep up with your children, so you can help them grow.
I don't even know if it's about being smarter. I think it feels to me more like being one or two chapters ahead in the book, you know.
Well, yeah, well, I had to learn fast in order to keep up to answer the questions is what it is, and I don't remember that it was that way with the two oldest, and I don't think it was that way with my parents. But it's as though, you know, we have to try and keep ahead of them so we can teach them, because it's so important for them to have role models. And sometimes there just aren't enough role models to go around.
Well, that's certainly something that I I talk about in all my interviews and talked about in Drunk with Wonder is, particularly as a male role model.
Oh, yes.
It's one of my big joys in the world is to show up as a, you know, as a big natural leader, a big man who I have a lot of love in my heart, and I'm a big hugger, and I love being warm, and being well acquainted with and comfortable with my feminine side. And I love being a nurturing grandpa. It's one of my favorite roles of my whole life. And I love showing up as a man who is secure in my being a man. And I can still, I love to cry. I love to feel my feelings. I love to be expressive. I love all of it, you see. That's really a big part of my message, is that we need to be able to embrace all of who we are in healthy and responsible ways, so that we don't wind up as some of these, you know, some of these people have been doing lately, where they're mowing people down because it's the only way that they can pop their balloon of this lifetime of unfelt feelings and this horrible miasma that they've gotten themselves trapped in.
Yes, and I also know that life goes on, and I know that it continues, and that there is forgiveness for all of these people. And the other thing that is very important in life is to forgive yourself. And when something occurs to you in the experiential context, to learn how to forgive those who have brought this experience, however terrifying, however sad it is, however much, whatever you might lose, it's forgiveness is key.
It is. And it's a huge key.
It's a huge key. You forgive them, and you forgive others. And once you have that key, you can have then the love, and then the trust, and the belief that all will be well. No one leaves this earth plane but what they have decided on the way they leave. And that's the other thing I believe, too, that we all, each of us, are here for a reason. And some people leave this earth plane in pain and in circumstances that leave others in pain because they are in out of love teaching us a lesson, maybe of letting go and growing. And that's another reason to look at what happens in life. And that's one of the hardest lessons to learn, I think, and to allow people to be forgiven and to forgive them for leaving us.
Oh, yeah. One of my best friends from high school committed suicide many years ago, and that was very challenging. And I've had family members. My grandfather killed himself, and a cousin was really... really hurting. He killed himself when he was 15, and it's really been around the too much in my, I say too much, it's been what it is. My brother married a woman with two kids, and the older daughter committed suicide about 3 years ago in her mid-20s.
Well,
yeah, so it's, you know, it's,
yes.
It's, I've got, you know, I have lots of, I said lots, plenty of experiences of shock and, and deep sadness and grief, and you're right, Phyllis. You can't express enough how much I agree with you that life does go on, and that or it can. I mean, we can get lost in that pit of despair. We absolutely can, and it's a choice. It may not feel like a choice. It may sound provocative for me to say it's a choice, but it is a choice. We can move on. There are tools and resources widely available to help us move through even the most devastating circumstances.
Well, thank you. Oh, we've come to the end of our course, and I thank you so much, Steve. I would love to have you again sometime. And
oh, great, Phyllis.
Another book, I'd love to get it, read it. I do read them cover to cover, believe me. I take my job seriously, actually, and... I think you have a lot of good to share with people. I am hopeful that many people listened with their hearts today, as well as with their minds, and that in broadcasting this, lives were touched and it will make a difference. Even if one person is touched, we've done the right thing, and we've gone down the right path with this.
That's
and
right.
I thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you're
and
so
the
welcome.
Writing of the book, and I continue to read parts of it because I find it relevant and I see it with fresh eyes.
Oh, thanks,
Thank
Phyllis.
Thank you so much, and God bless you all, and be sure and listen to next week. We have a wonderful man you might be interested in listening to, Steve, yourself, Dr. John Turner from Hawaii. He's a neurologist, and he's also a healer using alternative therapies, and he sounds just like a fabulous person. He's written a great book as well, and And he talks about healing and the brain and despair and so forth as well. So thank you all so much for listening. God bless you. You have a wonderful Easter, and I will talk with you all next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Blessings.
Thank you.